Hello and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very special guest on our podcast today, Dr. Brendan Nguyen. And the topic, the theme of this episode is really going to be all things kidney disease. So Dr. Nguyen, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and providing a little bit of background for our audience.
Thanks, Dr. Isaacs. My name is Brendan Nguyen. I'm a nephrologist and director of kidney trials at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, Australia, and a senior research fellow at the George Institute for Global Health, also in Sydney, Australia. I'm involved in a number of clinical trials that test the effects of therapeutic agents on slowing kidney disease progression, predominantly in people with type 2 diabetes, and I am the co-chair of the SGLT2 Trialists Consortium.
Wow, that's amazing.
We're so excited to have you, and we can't wait to hear about a new trial that was just published called FLOW.
Yeah, it's really exciting, a very exciting time for patients with type 2 diabetes and kidney disease, with the only dedicated kidney outcome trial of a GLP-1 receptor agonist, FLOW, which we know already is positive and is being reported in May, we now know, at the European Renal Association in Stockholm. So a really exciting time with the FLOW trial.
Can you tell us a little bit about that study? Yes. Can you tell us about how big was it? Is this something that we should say, okay, this changes practice, right? We're always, Diane and I see patients many days of the week, and we want to know, should this change my practice tomorrow?
So FLOW is a really important trial. It's, as I mentioned, it's the only dedicated kidney outcome trial of a GLP-1 receptor agonist. FLOW is testing the effects of semaglutide versus placebo in about 3,500 patients with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. And it is testing the effect of semaglutide on a primary outcome of 50% decline in GFR, kidney failure, or death due to cardiovascular or kidney disease. And what you might have already seen is that the trial stopped early at an interim analysis based on pre-specified stopping rules due to efficacy. And we know from what has been released that semaglutide reduced the risk of the primary outcome by 24%, which was driven by both components of the kidney disease progression and cardiovascular death components. And we look forward to seeing the results of this trial at ERA in Stockholm. But undoubtedly, this is going to be really important, and it's going to influence guidelines for millions of people worldwide who have type 2 diabetes and kidney disease.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Diana.
I'm blown away. It sounds like this really has the potential to majorly change our algorithm. I mean, right now, for those that have kidney disease and type 2 diabetes, SGLT2 inhibitors have been the preferred agent. And now it's really interesting. Do you have any information where patients in this trial, I know the full results aren't out yet, but were they already on SGLT2 inhibitors?
Yes, so this trial includes about 15% of people who were on SGLT2 inhibitors already at baseline. Some of your listeners might be surprised that that number is so low, but we have to remember that the trial was started only in 2019 or so. So some of that evidence and the guidelines hadn't diffused into clinical practice yet. But still, that is a reasonable proportion of people on SGLT2 inhibitors at baseline. I'm sure there will be more patients who start an SGLT2 inhibitor during the trial, but that should give at least some power to look at the effects with and without SGLT2 inhibitors, which I'm sure the investigators will present and people will be looking forward to hear.
Wow. Okay. So now the big questions, right? Because we don't have the full data and the full trial results. What does this change? What do I do next? So, you know, we control for blood pressure. In diabetes, on the diabetes end, we typically very quickly thereafter add an SGLT2, even if we see just a little bit of proteinuria. You know, that is sort of this drug works in diabetes, but it also helps protect kidney. Where does the drug Kerendia fall into that now? Can you talk about And now I've got to communicate more with my kidney people, which we get along and we do pretty well. So can we talk about all the different things you've heard so far? And I know that there are not guidelines yet. So this is more theoretical than anything else.
Of course. And before I answer that question, Dr. Bellini, I should also point out to your listeners that this population in flow is very much like Credence. It's a high-risk diabetes population. We're seeing people who, on average, had an average age of about 65 years of age, and they had a mean GFR of about 47 mils per minute and a median urine albumin to creatinine ratio of 568 milligrams per gram. So this is a very high-risk cohort with a high risk of not only kidney disease progression, but heart failure and cardiovascular disease as well. And that's important because these agents also reduce cardiovascular outcomes as well as slowing kidney disease progression. And I want to take a step back from what you've mentioned and just look at the historical view of where we are at the moment with diabetic kidney disease. We're in a time of incredible therapeutic advancement, which is really exciting for us as clinicians and great news for our patients. But it does now raise a really interesting question that you've also raised of how are we going to use these agents, in what combination, in what sequence? And I think now we have never had, at least in diabetic kidney disease, never had to worry about multiple agents because we only ever had one until very recently. That's RAS inhibition and now SGLT2 inhibitors. But now we've got multiple therapies. And I want to bring up this concept, which I think will become increasingly prevalent in the literature, which is a pillared approach to reducing complications due to diabetic kidney disease, or what I would call the four pillars. We have RAS inhibition as the first pillar, SGLT2 inhibitors as the second pillar, non-steroidal MRAs or finerenone as the third pillar, and the fourth pillar now will be GLP-1 receptor agonists. And interestingly, this pillared approach I think is important because it addresses all the different pathophysiological mechanisms that underlie the development and progression of diabetic kidney disease. We have SGLT2 inhibitors and RAS inhibitors that block the hemodynamic injury from diabetic kidney disease. We have non-steroidal MRAs that reduce inflammation and fibrosis, which we know is really important. And we have GLP-1 receptor agonists now, which address the underlying metabolic abnormalities that are pathognomonic of diabetic kidney disease. So these different therapies all target different pathways. And it's interesting that we now have four pillars of therapy for diabetic kidney disease, much in a similar way to how we have four pillars of therapy for heart failure. And it's very interesting, at least to me, that many of these pillars are actually similar. And what we're seeing is this convergence of guideline-directed therapy across these disease states, across cardio-kidney metabolic health. And that, I think, is the big story here, that the four pillars of guideline-directed therapy are actually converging across different disease states.
I love that. And I wonder, so I'm curious about the idea. So we in the ADA guidelines, recently, in the last couple of guidelines, they have fought, you know, they used to say metformin, and then when the A1C goes up, then do this. And then when the A1C goes up, do this, right? It was like this step approach. Now the ADA says, wait a minute, that makes no sense, right? So regardless of glucose control, add a GLP-1 if they're at higher risk for heart disease, add an SGLT2, even if their A1C is at goal for this, right? Like, and that those pillars have changed, because instead of just treat to this new target, treat to that number and do it after it happens, now we're doing it before, right? So look at the risk factors. And so do you feel like this is where the guidelines for the kidney are going to come to as well?
I think so, certainly. Like, if you look at the KDIGO guidelines for diabetic kidney disease, which are a living document, so they're updated very frequently, SGLT2 inhibitors are first line irrespective of glucose control. And then they suggest GLP-1s and non-steroidal MRAs as additional agents to reduce cardiorenal risk. Now, we're going to have to look at the flow data carefully, but I think what we're going to see is personalized add-on therapy after an SGLT2 inhibitor. With the data we've seen so far with non-steroidal MRAs, they have very prominent effects on kidney disease progression and heart failure, but the GLP-1s have potentially more beneficial effects on atherosclerotic events like MI and stroke. And we know that those types of outcomes are not modified with SGLT2 inhibitors or non-steroidal MRAs. So I think we're going to have to carefully personalize therapy after an SGLT2 inhibitor, add on these other agents depending on what patients' risk are of specific outcomes, and then also taking into account other factors such as overweight and obesity. If that is a more prominent feature, then perhaps adding a GLP-1 receptor agonist next would be useful. If they've got high levels of albuminuria and have a history of heart failure, then adding a non-steroidal MRA might be beneficial. If they have issues with hyperkalemia, then perhaps adding a GLP-1 receptor agonist next might be preferred over a non-steroidal MRA because of the increase in serum potassium with those agents. So I think we're going to have to personalize therapy. And I think the idea of how we sequence these therapies is a conversation that we haven't yet even started in nephrology. And we can learn a lot from heart failure and how the heart failure cardiologists are talking about sequencing of treatments. I think we have to rethink or reevaluate how we're going to sequence these agents, because the historical perspective may not be the best for everyone.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. That was going to be my question, because here you've got these four pillars, but how do you decide when and who and when you should be using all four? And I heard you mention about kind of starting with the SGLT2 inhibitor after the RAS inhibition, but I guess why the SGLT2 inhibitor? Should we be rethinking that? Should it be a GLP-1 agonist next? So it's a very interesting question. And of course, the three out of four of these drug classes currently are brand, so they're a little bit more expensive. So the cost, I think, does come into play as well, like what makes the most sense economically. When should we use each class?
Of course. And I think the other thing to point out, Dr. Isaacs, is if you take the historical approach, and the historical approach is the most conservative approach across disease states, then that is that we typically add on a new therapy in the order in which the evidence is derived. So we just add on an SGLT2 inhibitor first after RAS blockade, because that was what happened first.
Next, right, yeah.
And then we potentially add on a non-steroidal MRA because that was next, and then a GLP-1 after that because that was the clinical evidence came next. But that's not necessarily the right order exactly for the reasons you mentioned. And the other thing to say about that is that kind of stepwise approach, and the ADA guidelines suggest reevaluating risk factors every 6 months to avoid therapeutic inertia, means that for some individuals, that whole process might take 12 to 18 months. And if you look at what the excess risk of clinical events that are faced by these individuals, it's heart attack, stroke, and heart failure. And you look at the first 12 months in the CREDENCE trial, which I was involved in the reporting of, and there are four times as many cardiovascular events in the first 12 months as there are kidney disease progression events. So I do wonder whether or not that kind of historical approach, which relies on rechecking albuminuria, is actually a barrier to full implementation of guideline-directed therapy. Because anything that ties, if you tie a therapeutic intensification to a test, there is always a risk of therapeutic inertia. And so the other question, apart from the order in which we're starting them, is can we start them more quickly, indeed even simultaneously for some individuals, and what order that and how we might do that? That is a really critical question that we need to address in the nephrology community.
I think that, you know, we're doing that now. I mean, both Diana and I are in endocrinology. And so lots of times people come into our offices and go home on two or three different new medications, and some things are stopped and some things are started. But it does take that education. I am giving you this GLP-1 to help with glucose, right, management, but also to reduce your risk of heart attack and stroke. I am giving you this SGLT2 inhibitor to help with glucose and management, but you have protein in your urine. So we're going to protect that kidney and we're going to, right? So we will do a big flip. We don't see that happening as often. We do see it happening in some primary cares, but not as often, because the guidelines still say if you're not at goal, you know, revisit it. Even though the guidelines are now written to say people aren't always following that other part of the guideline, right? My mother died of a heart attack young. My brother had a heart attack at 54. You're getting a GLP-1. You're getting a GLP-1, right? You have obesity and your A1C is high. You're at such high risk, right? And the same with that SGLT2 inhibitor. It's like, I'm giving you a little bit of it. It's going to help your kidney. If you have a kidney, if you've been referred to nephrology and you haven't seen them yet, you're getting an SGLT2 inhibitor, right? You should not walk into a nephrologist without one, you know? I mean, it should be rare that that happens. And we both know that it happens all the time. So, you know, that's kind of what we do in diabetes. And so we are doing that. And I think, like you said, nephrology will probably do that if you're not even already, right? Good. But what happens with, how do we get people to, I think the guidelines need to be as direct as possible, because if when their guidelines are a little bit wishy, then nothing gets done because you don't know and you're afraid to do anything. So then you say, all right, go to nephrology, right?
Yeah. I agree with you. And I know, and you know from our practice that, you know, you have a 50-year-old patient with a UACR of 900, an SGLT2 inhibitor is not going to cut it. You know, they are going to need multiple therapies to reduce their risk of kidney disease progression. And so why aren't we using a combination therapy up front in those individuals who we know are going to need more than one agent? And I think, you know, there are three potential models that I think we could think about in terms of using these multiple agents. One is the traditional route, which we've talked about, and the downside of that is therapeutic inertia, and many patients will experience cardiovascular events before they get up titrated. If you take the opposite, you know, turn 180 degrees, which is the throw everything at everyone immediately. And I think the problem with that is a couple of things. Firstly, cost, like you mentioned, is a major issue that we can't shy away from, at least in the United States. And secondly, we don't know what the safety of doing of that such an intensive strategy might be. And at least three of the four pillars have hemodynamic effects on the kidney or cause acute reductions in GFR. And certainly, I think there is some justified reluctance into starting all of these medications at the same time because of the possible risk of acute kidney injury and acute decreases in GFR. And so I think that is one of the challenges of using multiple therapies at once. And the other challenge is with kidney disease, risk of kidney failure is really heterogeneous. Not everyone has the same risk of kidney failure. Some people will more likely die due to non-cardiovascular or other causes of death before they reach kidney failure. Some people will almost certainly reach kidney failure. And so I think what a hybrid of those two approaches is stratifying their risk of kidney disease progression using like the KDIGO heat map or kidney failure risk equation. And then for the really high risk patients, high or very high risk patients, you know, those are the patients who you want accelerated implementation of the four pillars. And then in the low to moderate risk patients, perhaps the historical approach of sequential add-on supporting primary care might be the best approach. So I think it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all, but we're going to have to find ways to logically use combination therapy. And I think the most logical way, in my view, is to stratify their baseline risk and then individualize the intent, then you can match the intensity of treatment with their risk. And if you look at other disease states, COPD, rheumatoid arthritis, HIV, that is the exact same approach that they take in those diseases. You don't go and see a rheumatologist who starts you on like a little bit of methotrexate, waits 6 months for more joint erosion, then adds on something else, and then something else once disease progression or joint erosion has already occurred. No, they stratify your risk up front and then tailor your therapy, the intensity, to how high your risk is. And I think that is the way forward here in diabetic kidney disease.
That makes perfect sense. And I really hope you are involved in writing these updated guidelines, because yes, that is very clear and that really, really makes sense. One of the things that I sometimes am concerned about is just that I think it's straightforward when someone is not on insulin or not on a sulfonylurea. But we know when we start adding these therapies, especially GLP-1 agonists, because SGLT2 inhibitors start working as well for glucose lowering when that GFR is declined. But GLP-1 agonists are going to definitely still work for that glucose lowering. And so one of the barriers I've seen, like sometimes in primary care or other areas, is that, gosh, what do we do with the insulin now? We're adding this agent, and how do we decrease it? What do we do? And so I'm kind of curious, in the nephrology world, are there, I mean, I don't know, it's probably different in Australia, but do you guys, are there ever any barriers in terms of like starting these medications and what to do with our other diabetes medications?
Yeah, you know, I think you raise a really good point, Dr. Isaacs, and it is a real barrier. I think it's not US, I think it is everywhere, in that nephrologists can be reluctant to adjust background glucose lowering agents. And that's part of that has been what has helped the implementation of SGLT2 inhibitors in many respects, is that for most patients who we see in nephrology clinics with low GFR, we don't need to adjust their other background glucose lowering agents because there is no effect on HbA1c. So this is a completely different story here. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of education to be done and collaborative care that needs to occur to fully implement these therapies, because I do think that nephrologists are going to be reluctant to do this without the support of endocrinologists in many cases.
And some of that's going to be communicating through the electronic health system and just saying, you know, we saw this due to, and quoting that study, quoting the flow study in your chart note or in your referral letter back and saying, this patient would benefit from a GLP-1. They are also on basal insulin and their A1C is whatever. I am sending this back to ask about reduction in that insulin level. Please contact me, right? I mean, we could do that through Epic and REHR now to try to get this to happen quickly. I mean, we get notes like that now on other medical conditions. And I think that as we see these patients and start talking about this, I think that's how that it's going to work the easiest, is to communicate back and forth so that the whole chart is visible to the different clinicians and they can see why, and getting that data out. I mean, the flow data is profound. You know, this is something that these people need to use on top of what they're using now. Again, am I helping them improve quality of life, but also duration, right? So I think that that's where that might be part of the solution. And again, education around it. People will need to hear about this data in order to feel comfortable doing it.
Agreeing with you, Dr. Blaney, that I think that, familiarity will come with more experience, and nephrologists will become more comfortable adjusting background glucose lowering agents and insulin once they've had more experience with it. But I those kinds of interactions that you describe are the same kinds of interactions we have in Australia. So I think those conversations are going to become more common and much more important.
One of the other challenges that we faced is just that people aren't necessarily screened, or they're screened and they have kidney disease, but no one's really ever talked to them about it. And I wonder if some of that's just that until now or until more recently, we didn't really have so many therapies. So people just kind of walked around, they had kidney disease, but they didn't know. And so I'm kind of curious your experience with this, in terms of efforts to just like make sure there's awareness that people are getting screened and that they know if they have it. And that way people can also advocate for themselves that they're getting the therapies that can help them.
I think that, you know, this issue of screening for kidney disease, chronic kidney disease, has had a experienced a huge resurgence in importance now. For the reason that you outlined, now that we have multiple therapies, we can actually do something about it. But if you look at who gets tested for albuminuria, it is still woeful across almost every health system across the world, even patients with type 2 diabetes, many of whom need to get tested but never get tested for albuminuria. And even people with other risk factors like hypertension and obesity don't get tests. And there's some data that indicates 70% of people with albuminuria don't know they have it. So I think there's a lot more work to be done in terms of screening for albuminuria. GFR is so wide, is so pervasive because it's a blood test and you see your eGFR all the time. But I'd like to see more referrals to my practice with people with normal kidney function who have severely increased albuminuria, because early detection is where we can make the biggest difference for preventing kidney failure. Too often we see people who've already experienced substantial kidney disease progression, and there's only so much you can do about it at a later stage, but in terms of preventing progression. But it's those earlier cases that are really important. I think that's where endocrinology and primary care, and indeed cardiovascular medicine, has a really important role to play in increasing the uptake of albuminuria screening.
I love that. Yeah, really embracing that team-based care. So I have one more probably final question for you, because I know we've taken a lot of your time and this has just been such an amazing conversation. So 50 years ago, when you were diagnosed, if someone was diagnosed with diabetes, 50% of those people ended up in end-stage renal disease. Where are we now? And where do you think the FLOW trial brings us to, if we treat early, obviously? Because 50 years ago, there wasn't. We controlled blood sugar, maybe, right? There was still urine testing. We tried to control blood pressure, but the guidelines were so much higher than they are now. So where are we now with that, with that data? Or with that prognosis?
Yeah. So if you look at historically the rates of GFR decline in epidemiological and clinical trials, we can see that before the advent of ACE inhibitors and ARBs, people losing 10 mils per minute per year, reaching kidney failure very rapidly. Then that has slowly changed over time. So to 5 mils per minute with RAS inhibition, 2.5 mils per minute with SGLT2 inhibitors, 2.5 mils per minute per year. And we're getting to the point where we can potentially slow kidney disease progression or to the point of normal aging for many individuals who are at high risk. That is going to be really make a really profound impact if we fully implement these therapies. And indeed, if you look at projection, epidemiological projection data, these therapies, if they are fully implemented, will change the epidemiology of the disease worldwide. And that is really, really exciting. But it's incumbent on the implementation of these therapies. And neutralizes my excitement to some extent is that if we look at RAS inhibition, which has been available for 20 years, is off patent. We know that even in people with albuminuria kidney disease, there are at least 40 to 50% of people who should be on ACE inhibitors and ARBs who are not on them, which highlights that even for a readily available therapy, generic therapy, there are still very, very big implementation gaps. We all know from clinical experience, people get hospitalized, they have acute kidney injury or something else or an infection, the ARB is stopped, it doesn't get restarted for another couple of years, and then they've experienced kidney disease progression because they've got proteinuric CKD. So all of these gaps are really important for us to think about in terms of addressing implementation. And we can only really achieve the promise of these therapies if we fully implement them. And that is now really the challenge for everyone in this field.
Wow, what an incredible conversation. I am so glad you joined us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I know our listeners will enjoy it. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in to this amazing episode on kidney disease and diabetes. That concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, and we hope you will join us next time.